What? My radio stuck on CKUT. And you don't know? Me nah fix it. CKUT, the number one radio station in Montreal. We give you the sun, the moon, the rain, the stars and the mountain. CKUT give you the world.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We are moving today to vacate the convictions and dismiss the indictments of Muhammad Aziz and Khalil Islam for the assassination of Malcolm X on February 21, 1965.
A New York judge exonerates two men convicted of killing Malcolm X after the Manhattan DA, Cy Vance, accused former FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover of hiding evidence decades ago that would have proven the two men were innocent. We'll speak with the independent researcher Abdurrahman Mohammed, whose work played a key role in spurring the new investigation. Then Angela Davis responds to North Dakota banning teaching critical race theory in schools.
What we are witnessing are efforts on the part of the forces of white supremacy to regain a control which they more or less had in the past.
Then to miseducation, how climate change is taught in America. We'll talk to author Katie Wirth. And we go to British Columbia, where Canadian police have raided a First Nations blockade to prevent construction of a new pipeline on Indigenous land.
The RCMP are invading Wet'suwet'en territory once again. There have been approximately 15 arrests that have happened already at Gidimden Checkpoint. Legal observers, media have been arrested. Two of our Wet'suwet'en elders have been arrested and removed from the territory. Right now we're at Coyote Camp and the RCMP are moving in to remove me from my territory.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The House of Representatives is set to vote today on a 10-year, roughly $2 trillion bill to combat the climate crisis while expanding social programs. The vote comes after Republican Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy spent more than 8 hours delaying a planned vote Thursday with a long and winding speech attacking Democrats over spending, the border crisis, China, Afghanistan, gas prices, and more. The latest version of the Build Back Better Act is dramatically smaller than initially proposed after conservative Senate Democrats Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin demanded cuts. But it still contains many key elements of President Biden's legislative agenda. Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt Thursday halted the planned execution of Julius Jones, a black man who was sentenced to death for a 1999 murder he's always insisted he did not commit. And Jones' reprieve came just hours before he was scheduled to die by lethal injection last night. Hundreds of death penalty opponents erupted in cheers inside the Oklahoma state capitol as news broke that Julius Jones' life had been spared. But as a condition of granting clemency, Governor Stitt said Jones will never be eligible for commutation, pardon, or parole for the rest of his life. This is Reverend Christine Byrd, a longtime supporter of Julius Jones and his family.
I am overjoyed. I know that some people will not see it as a victory, but Julius' life is spared today, and so I am thankful that there will not be an execution today. Would we have wanted something different? Yes, but I am thankful that he will live another day.
In Louisiana, 75-year-old Henry Montgomery walked out of Angola prison Wednesday, winning parole nearly 58 years after he was sentenced to life in prison for a crime he committed as a teenager. Montgomery's case was central to a Supreme Court ruling that extended the possibility of parole to hundreds of people with life sentences for juvenile crimes. In international news, Belarus Thursday opened a heated warehouse to hundreds of asylum seekers who spent days enduring winter weather and squalid conditions in tent encampments along the Polish border. European Union countries have accused Belarus of tricking migrants into massing at the border in retaliation for EU sanctions. Belarus, meanwhile, accused its neighbors of brutality against the refugees. Video distributed by Belarus shows Polish border guards kicking an Iraqi asylum seeker in a sleeping bag and sicking a dog on him. Elsewhere, three photojournalists covering the crisis say Polish border guards verbally abused and handcuffed them while authorities searched their equipment. Meanwhile, over 400 Iraqi asylum seekers were deported from Minsk Thursday. This is Mohsen Adi, a member of Iraq's persecuted Yazidi community, speaking after arriving at an airport in Iraqi Kurdistan.
I would have stayed till death, but my family was in danger. If the situation doesn't improve in Iraq in a year or two, I'll leave again. If there's no solution, I'll be forced to leave.
Austrian officials are reimposing a nationwide lockdown and will require nearly all residents to be vaccinated by February 1st after COVID-19 cases hit a record high. It's the first such vaccine mandate in Europe. In Germany, officials said they'll exclude unvaccinated people from some public venues in areas where hospitals are becoming overwhelmed with patients. Russia reported a record number of COVID deaths today for the third straight day, with over 1,250 fatalities. The WHO says Europe is the current epicenter of the pandemic and the only region where deaths are on the rise. Meanwhile, a new study published in the British Medical Journal found mask wearing cuts coronavirus transmission rates by more than half, while hand washing and physical distancing sharply reduce the risk of getting infected. In Canada, an estimated 18,000 people remain cut off by floodwaters and mudslides after torrential rains brought what officials have described as a 1-in-500-year flood. The crisis is on track to become the costliest natural disaster in Canadian history. The disaster struck the same region that endured record-shattering temperatures and unprecedented wildfires over the summer brought on by the climate crisis. Later in the broadcast, we'll go to British Columbia, where Canadian police have raided a First Nations blockade to prevent construction of a new pipeline on Indigenous land. In Kenya, the United Nations warns some 2.5 million people are struggling to find food after a searing drought killed off livestock and led to widespread crop failures. Parts of northern Kenya have received less than 30% of normal rainfall levels. Brazilian government data show for deforestation in the Amazon rainforest has reached its highest level in over 15 years, increasing by 22% in the past year. At the recent UN climate summit, Brazil pledged to end and reverse deforestation by 2030. Meanwhile, in Ecuador, a historic hearing was held this week in the Amazonian jungle over a plan to expand mining in the region, which indigenous communities oppose and say cannot go ahead without free and informed consent. This is the Huarani activist and 2020 Goldman Environmental Prize winner, Namantin Nkimo.
After this hearing, we are hoping they will do the same thing in other indigenous nations where there are similar cases which we've won, and we want it to be enforced. Decision-making in the territory is our decision.
Indian authorities have extended a shutdown on schools as the toxic air pollution smothering the capital, Delhi, worsens. All schools and colleges are now indefinitely closed, and over half the city's 11 coal-based power plants have been ordered to stop operations. In other news from India, Prime Minister Narendra Modi announced his government's withdrawing the highly contested agricultural laws that triggered mass mobilizations across India over the past year. It's a major victory for farmers who argued the reforms deregulating agricultural markets would eliminate key labor and income protections. Concerns are mounting for the Chinese tennis star Peng Shuai, who mysteriously disappeared from public view after she accused a top Chinese politician of sexual assault. The 35-year-old Peng made the accusation against former Vice Premier Zhang Gaoli in a social media post on November 2nd. She has not been seen since. Censors deleted the post from social media platform Weibo within 30 minutes of its publication, and Chinese authorities have since dodged or denied the issue. The Women's Tennis Association threatened to cut ties with China and say an email published by Chinese state media purportedly written to the WTA by Peng was a fraud. Tennis's biggest names, including Naomi Osaka and Serena Williams, have tweeted out messages of support with the hashtag, Where is Peng Shuai? In Georgia, defense attorneys rested their case Thursday after calling just 7 witnesses in the trial of 3 white men who chased down and shot dead 25-year-old Ahmaud Arbery. Under cross-examination, Travis McMichael conceded Arbery did not threaten him in any way before McMichael took out his shotgun. He also conceded that his claim that Arbery grabbed his gun contradicted what he told police hours after the shooting. Outside the courthouse, hundreds of black pastors, including the Reverend Al Sharpton, gathered for a rally a week after a defense attorney unsuccessfully attempted to ban them from the courtroom. Closing arguments are scheduled for Monday. The city of Aurora, Colorado, has agreed to pay $15 million to settle a civil rights lawsuit brought by the family of Elijah McClain, the 23-year-old black man who was tackled by police, placed in a chokehold, and later injected with a large amount of the powerful sedative ketamine. He died several days later. At the time, McClain was walking home with an iced tea from the corner store. And a Senate debate over President Biden's nominee to become a top banking regulator turned acrimonious Thursday after Louisiana Republican Senator John Kennedy accused her of loyalty to the Communist Party of the former Soviet Union. If confirmed, Sahli Amirova would become the first woman, the first immigrant, and the first person of color to serve as controller of the currency. Amirova grew up in Soviet Kazakhstan, came to the U.S. in 1991. As a child, she was required to join a Soviet youth group. That became the basis for Senator Kennedy's questioning.
I don't mean any disrespect. I don't know whether to call you professor or comrade.
Oh, my goodness. Senator, I'm not a communist. I do not subscribe to that ideology. I could not choose where I was born.
Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren rushed to Amirova's defense.
The attacks on your nomination have been vicious and personal. We've just seen them. Sexism, racism, pages straight out of Joe McCarthy's 1950s Red Scare tactics. It is all there on full display. Welcome to Washington in 2021.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A New York judge has exonerated 2 men convicted in the assassination of Malcolm X in the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem, February 21, 1965. This came after the Manhattan District Attorney's Office and the Innocence Project conducted a nearly 2-year investigation that uncovered key evidence was withheld at the trial of the 2 men, 83-year-old Muhammad Aziz and Khalil Islam, who died in 2009. On Thursday, Manhattan District Attorney Cy Vance apologized in court to Aziz and the family of Islam. Vance also called out former FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover.
We have obtained dozens and dozens of reports from the FBI and the NYPD's Bureau of Special Services and investigations. These records include FBI reports of witnesses who failed to identify Mr. Islam and who implicated other subjects and suspects. And significantly, we now have reports revealing that on orders from Director J. Edgar Hoover himself, the FBI ordered multiple witnesses not to tell police or prosecutors that they were, in fact, FBI informants. Many of those documents were exculpatory. None of them were disclosed to the defense.
That was the Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance speaking through his mask. 83-year-old Muhammad Aziz also addressed the court. He was jailed for almost 2 decades for the killing of Malcolm X before being released on parole in 1985. He's been fighting to clear his name ever since. Listen carefully, because he, too, is wearing a mask.
The event that brought us to court today should never have occurred. Those events were and are the result of a process that was corrupt to its core, one that was all too familiar to black people in 2021. While I do not need this court, these prosecutors, or a piece of paper to tell me I'm innocent, I am very glad that my family, my friends, and the attorneys who have worked and supported me all of these years are finally saying the truth that we have all known, officially recognized. I am an 83-year-old man who was victimized by the criminal justice system. I do not know how many more years of creative activity I have. However, I hope the same system that was responsible for this travesty of justice also takes responsibility for the immeasurable harm caused to me during the last 55 or 56 years. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mohammed Aziz speaking Thursday in a New York courtroom. He was exonerated for his role in the assassination of Malcolm X. The latest investigation into Malcolm's murder in 1965 was spurred by the Netflix documentary series Who Killed Malcolm X, which was largely based on research done by Abdurrahman Mohammed, an independent scholar and historian who spent decades investigating the life and death of Malcolm X. In a moment, Abdurrahman Mohammed will join us. But first, this is the trailer to Who Killed Malcolm X.
We're not brutalized because we're Muslims. We're brutalized because we are black people in America.
Power of this man's courage to say this stuff. It changed the entire trajectory of my life.
He was becoming a figure that transcended the Nation of Islam.
It was politics that really started the rift between Malcolm and the nation.
The white man is the greatest hate teacher that ever lived there.
The FBI was deathly afraid of someone like Malcolm X.
What kind of democracy is that?
People had to start wondering if something happens to Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm becomes the leader, it's over for all of us.
And just then the gunfire went off.
Malcolm's death never sat right with me.
The investigation was a failure.
Asking who's guilty is a dangerous question to ask.
What is the real story?
It's in the history book. Leave it there. Leave it alone.
Elijah Muhammad told everybody, do not raise a hand against Malcolm X.
He didn't have to give the order. Someone would take care of him.
The FBI should have known.
Why doesn't someone want to get to the bottom of this?
They never had any intentions of seriously investigating that assassination.
That is my mission. I'm not going to stop until I get justice. Because the official count of who killed Malcolm X, it's not true.
Those are the words of Abdurrahman Mohammed in the trailer of the 2020 Netflix documentary series, Who Killed Malcolm X? Abdurrahman Mohammed joins us now. Welcome back to Democracy Now! You were in the courtroom yesterday. Can you describe the scene? You have two men who served each more than 20 years in prison for the assassination of Malcolm X. One of them died, Khalil Islam, more than a decade ago. But Mohammed Aziz stood there in the courtroom. Talk about the moment. Describe the scene.
Amy, it was a beautiful fall afternoon. The weather couldn't have been better in New York. When we sat down, we had to process what we were witnessing. It was surreal. It was almost out of body to be sitting there and watching an exoneration, not a pardon, an exoneration after a half a century, of a man who was still living, a man present, 83 years old, and to watch the government admit that these brothers were sent to prison for a crime they didn't commit was stunning. It was stunning. It was breathtaking, honestly. I mean, it just took my breath away.
And a lot of this is based on your research, a lay historian who just devoted your life to uncovering what happened. Can you talk about who Mujahid Abdul Halim is, who spoke to a reporter yesterday briefly to the New York Times in favor of the exoneration and his role in the assassination?
Well, Mujahid Abdul Halim, back in those days, the winter of 1965, was known as Talmadge Hayer. At the time he was arrested, he was known, the name that was put on his jacket was Thomas Hagen. But he is one of the confessed assassins who was caught at the scene. One of Malcolm's bodyguards shot him in the leg, and he was literally stomped almost to death outside the Audubon Ballroom. He was convicted for the crime, along with Muhammad Aziz, who was Norman 3X Butler at that time, and Khalil Islam, Thomas 15X Johnson. He is the one who gave us the names of the real assassins. And Amy, I would say this, that it was our revelation, the revelation that I published in 2010 of the identity of al-Mustafa Shabazz William X. Bradley, that revived this entire investigation. Before that, and before his name appearing in Manning Marable's book, crediting that revelation to me, the little independent scholar here in Washington, D.C., it completely blew the lid off this whole case, revived it from the dead, literally from the dead, and that material finds its way into who killed Malcolm X, and we have what we have today. And I'm appreciative to the lawyers, David Shaney and Barry Sheck, for acknowledging that in the courtroom. Talmadge Hayer filed this affidavit in 1977 and 78, where he named his four accomplices. It was an affidavit that was ignored by the criminal justice system. There it was, laid out in black and white, their names, you know, how they carried out the assassination, how they planned it. Law enforcement never, ever, ever made any attempt to arrest those men.
I only wish Manning Marable and Les Payne, two great writers, could be with us today as well. Both died on the eve of the publication of their books on Malcolm X. But I wanted to go to the clip from that Netflix docuseries, Who Killed Malcolm X, where you, our guest, Abdurrahman Mohammed, describes footage of the scene outside the Audubon Ballroom after the assassination.
The coroner ruled the cause of death to be the shotgun pellet. It wasn't the wounds from the shooters after the shot that killed Malcolm X. The cause of death was ruled to be the sawed-off shotgun.
Rally attendees seized one of the gunmen as he tried to escape the Audubon.
There is archival film of the scene outside the Audubon Ballroom right after the assassination.
Policemen engaged in a brutal tug-of-war.
You see a scuffle between the police and the crowd that was trying to beat down Talmadge Hayer, the only one of the assassins to confess. And there's a man standing on the edge of that crowd who looks a lot like William Bradley, who, according to Hayer, fired the shotgun that killed Malcolm. And he's feigning like he's part of the brawl. And in that kind of misdirection, he steps back, and then you see him walk across the frame very calmly, closing his coat, and he just walks away. This is how he got away. If William Bradley is the man who pulled off that shotgun and took the life of Malcolm X, and I can prove it, I want to confront him face to face.
And talk about whether you ever did confront him, but talk about who William Bradley is and how this was suppressed for decades.
That's right. William, he's called in Talmadge Hayer's affidavit William X. William X. Bradley was a lieutenant in Muhammad's Mosque number 25 in Newark, the temple where the assassins hail from. He was, he was a street thug. He was a bank robber. He was very proficient with a sawed-off shotgun, which is the reason why he was selected to carry out the assassination of Malcolm X, because they knew he could accomplish the task. Long criminal record, especially after Malcolm's assassination. He lived a life unmolested in Newark. He was never approached by law enforcement about the assassination of Malcolm X. He did spend many years in prison for other crimes, but not the killing of Brother Malcolm.
And did you get a chance to talk to him?
Did not get a chance to talk to him. I mean, there's no way in the world I would have approached that man's house by myself. The truth of the matter is that what I did is really the work of law enforcement. I can't walk up into a dangerous felon's house and say, you know, why did you kill Malcolm X? Why did you murder Malcolm X, right? You need a team, you need security. And by the time, you know, we was able to put together the team for who killed Malcolm X, where I, you know, had proper security and be able to make that move, unfortunately, he passed away in the middle of production as we were on the cusp of visiting his home there in Newark, New Jersey.
So I want to go to the issue of all the FBI informants involved here. Let's go to another clip from the documentary series Who Killed Malcolm X.
In the 1960s, the FBI launched one of the biggest counterintelligence operations in its entire history.
Black people everywhere today are fed up with the hypocrisy practiced by whites.
And they kept a very close watch on Brother Malcolm.
And if something isn't done, then I'm afraid that you will have a racial explosion, and a racial explosion is more deadly than an atomic explosion.
J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI, was deathly afraid of someone like Malcolm X.
Malcolm was being surveilled. He was being followed. His phone was tapped.
If you look at the investigation of Malcolm X, it's when he becomes a public figure for the Nation of Islam that the Bureau starts taking more of an interest into his subversive rhetoric.
You seem to be dissatisfied with everything. Just what do you want?
I'm not dissatisfied with everything. I'm just telling you that the Negroes themselves should take whatever steps necessary to defend themselves.
The FBI had multiple high-ranking paid human informants in the leadership of the Nation of Islam. Could it have been that FBI informants were actively involved in Malcolm's murder? Almost certainly so.
Some members of the Nation of Islam became willing tools, but they were the puppets. The puppeteers were in charge of that whole situation.
That's just another clip from the Netflix series Who Killed Malcolm X that everyone should see, that really features Abdurrahman Mohammed, our guest, who is the lay historian who laid out this research, has spent his life, all his off time working at various jobs, really investigating this. It is truly amazing, Abdurrahman. Talk about the FBI informants and others who were not identified at the time, suppressed by J. Edgar Hoover. This was raised by Cy Vance in the courtroom.
This is absolutely stunning, but not when you think about what an evil individual J. Edgar Hoover was. J. Edgar Hoover was perfectly okay with allowing two innocent men to rot in prison for 20 years, was supposed to be for the rest of their lives. Yes, we know for a fact, and have known for quite a while, that there were nine undercover FBI informants in the Autobahn ballroom that day. They filed reports in which they described the assassins to a T, especially William Bradley, the shotgun killer. They described him from head to toe, exactly what he looked like. It's right there in the FBI documents. They had this material like the next day, February 22nd. They knew what the shotgun assassin looked like. They were receiving information that this came from Newark. They knew all of this, yet J. Edgar Hoover, to protect his assets, just denied the district or the prosecutor, denied them access to these witnesses who could have exonerated these men and kept them from wasting away all of those decades behind bars.
As Cy Vance said in court, we now have reports on orders from Director J. Edgar Hoover himself. The FBI ordered multiple witnesses not to tell police or prosecutors that they were, in fact, FBI informants. Many of those documents were exculpatory. None of them were disclosed to the defense. We want to end with Amin Johnson, who spoke to reporters shortly after his late father, Khalil Isham, who died in 2009, was exonerated for killing Malcolm X.
Bittersweet, emotions running everywhere. Um, The fact that my father and my mother weren't here, are not here alive to see this and to experience the exoneration is painful because they suffered a lot. They suffered a lot. I believe that their deaths was a direct result of the stress and drama and trauma and post-traumatic stress that this whole situation has caused on them. So I can't say that I'm completely happy because they're not here, and I think that the effects of it remove them from our lives.
So that is Amin Johnson, who spoke to reporters shortly after his late father, Khalil Islam, and Muhammad Aziz, who is still alive, were exonerated in court yesterday in New York. Abdurrahman Muhammad, we thank you so much for being with us and for your devoted work to Who Killed Malcolm X, the independent scholar, historian, journalist, writer, and activist, widely regarded as one of the most respected authorities on the life and legacy of Malcolm X, featured in that 2020 Netflix documentary, Who Killed Malcolm X. Next up, Angela Davis responds to North Dakota banning teaching critical race theory in schools. And we look at miseducation, how climate change is taught in America. Stay with us.
To those who tell us to flee his memory, we smile and say to you, have you ever talked to Brother Malcolm, or have him smile at you?
Malcolm's Theme by Kamasi Washington. The words are taken from Ossie Davis's eulogy for Malcolm X at his funeral. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to look at two education stories and how right-wing forces are trying to prevent students from learning about the climate emergency as well as the racist history of the United States. North Dakota's Republican Governor Doug Burgum recently signed legislation banning the teaching of critical race theory. Public schools are now barred from teaching students that, quote, racism is systemically embedded in American society. Critics say the law could ban the teaching of slavery, redlining, and the civil rights movement. Even discussion of the law is now prohibited in North Dakota schools. Well, on Thursday, I spoke with the legendary academic, scholar, activist Angela Davis and asked her about what was happening in North Dakota and other states across the country.
I think that what we are witnessing at this moment is a profound clash between forces of the past and forces of the future. Campaign against teaching critical race theory in schools. You know, first of all, critical race theory is not taught in high schools. And I wish more critical race theory were taught at the university level. But critical race theory has become a watchword for any conversations about racism, any effort to engage in the education of students in our schools about the history of this country and of the Americas and of the planet. Any discussions about slavery as the foundational element of this country are being barred according to the proponents of removing, quote, critical race theory from the schools. But let's not be misled by the term they are using. What we are witnessing are efforts on the part of the forces of white supremacy to regain a control which they more or less had in the past. I think that it is absolutely essential to engage in the kinds of efforts to prevent them from consolidating a victory in the realm of education. And of course, those of us who are active in the abolitionist movement see education as central to the process of dismantling the prison, as central to the process of imagining new forms of safety and security that can supplant the violence of the police.
That's the scholar and activist Angela Davis speaking Thursday. Well, on the evening of December 7th, we hope you will join us with Angela Davis and many others for a virtual celebration to mark Democracy Now!'s 25th anniversary. Other guests will include Noam Chomsky and Arundhati Roy, Winona LaDuke and Greta Thunberg, Martina Spada, the National Book Award winner, Danny DeVito, plus musical guests Lila Downs and Tom Morello. You can visit democracynow.org for more information about the online event December 7th, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. We hope you will be there. Well, speaking of education, we reported extensively this month on how students and young people led the push to address the climate crisis at the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow, where the largest contingent was fossil fuel lobbyists. Now we look at how the fossil fuel industry is actually shaping climate education here in the United States. In Texas, the State Board of Education is set to vote as soon as today on whether new science standards for middle schoolers should include climate change. The language they choose will ultimately dictate how textbooks nationwide address the issue. This week, the board watered down the standards after hearing from oil and gas lobbyists. This is Member Pam Little.
I would propose that we have 8C to say simply discuss the pros and cons of all sources of energy.
We have a second. Motion or second? You want to speak to your motion?
I just think that this will give our students the opportunity to do the things that we want them to do. It will give them the opportunity to think critically.
Earlier this month, climate scientists across Texas sent a letter to the Texas State Board of Education urging them to revise the proposed curriculum to reflect how human activities such as the release of greenhouse gases has affected the climate. For more, we're joined in Dallas, Texas, by Katie Wirth, an investigative reporter who visited schools across the United States and found corporate and political influences are interfering with students' climate education. Her new book is just out this week. It's titled Miseducation: How Climate Change is Taught in America. She has a new piece out in the Washington Post headlined, Kids Are Living with Climate Catastrophe. That doesn't mean they believe in it. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Katie. Congratulations on the publication of your book. Why don't you start by talking about what's happening where you are in Texas?
Yeah, so this week, the State Board of Education is considering what should be in Texas standards about climate change. Standards are sort of arcane, but they are ultimately are kind of a state's greatest lever of control over what is taught in their schools. So, for example, you know, a standard is just, it's like their expectation of what a child should learn in a given grade level. So, like, in math, they'll learn math. In third grade math, they might learn multiplication tables. So what we saw this week is that for the first time, they're considering including climate change in their science standards. And that's a big deal because until recently in Texas, kids might not even hear the words climate change on school grounds unless they took like an advanced environmental science class. Since they were proposed, there have been a bunch of efforts to water down those standards. So, for example, a standard that said, you know, describe efforts to mitigate climate change, including a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, was stricken and replaced with what you just heard on the tape.
And tell us more how it played out and what exactly might be voted on as early as today, Katie.
Well, they're going to be including some information about climate change, both about natural climate change and human-caused climate change. But again, the language has sort of been attenuated by board members who are very sympathetic to the fossil fuel industry, which, as we know, is very powerful here in Texas. So, for example, there was an effort to include the word "can" from the phase describe how human activities can influence climate. And some of the board members were saying, let's just say human activities influence climate, because that is now an understood truth. But the other board members really wanted to keep that "can" in there, which, you know, it seems really subtle, right? But they can have a powerful effect when it comes to how teachers teach it. And then, of course, you know, textbook publishers are paying really close attention to these battles, to what happens in these hearings, because they then write that information into the textbooks that are sold all across the country.
Hmm. I want to go right now to another clip. In another state. This is a children's storybook produced by the Oklahoma Energy Resource Board, a fossil fuel lobbying group. This one is called Petro Pete's Big Bad Dream, when he has a nightmare about what life would be like if we didn't have petroleum.
Pete runs to the bathroom to brush his teeth and comb his hair for school, but his toothbrush and comb are missing. Pete shakes his head and doesn't know what to do.
Pete, you better hurry up. You don't want to be late for school,
Pete's mom yells from the kitchen. Pete heads outside in his pajamas to wait for the bus. As the sun comes up, Pete realizes the bus driver must have forgotten about him. He thinks about taking his bike, but the tires are missing. Pete decides that he has to walk to school.
So climate miseducation is not just a problem in Texas, Katie Wirth. You have traveled this country. I won't ask you if you use fossil fuels going to classrooms. But talk about both what's happening here in Oklahoma with Petro Pete and around the country, what kids are learning.
Yeah, well, there's a long history of the fossil fuel industry trying to get their messages to children, because that shapes how kind of future generations will think about their industry and how they will regulate their industry. And so the latest iteration of this is, as you heard, you know, like getting to students through storybooks, through presentations, through field trips, through teacher trainings. That same state agency that created that storybook offers a training for teachers if they come to a workshop that's sponsored by the fossil fuel industry. They walk away with a tub of lab equipment worth $300 to $500, which is a really big deal in a place like Oklahoma, where education is really underfunded. So it's pretty ubiquitous, and it's also pretty insidious.
So let's go to your hometown of Chico, California, not far from the town of Paradise, that was burned down in California's deadliest wildfire. And talk about how climate change is being taught in Chico, where many climate refugees from Paradise now go to school.
Yeah, well, I had the opportunity right after the mega fire burned down Paradise. Those schools were almost all displaced into Chico, and the Paradise Intermediate School was displaced into a hardware store, a shuttered hardware store, so basically like a Lowe's. They turned aisles into classrooms. The checkout counters were where the lunch lady served the meals. It was all very surreal, but the teachers and the kids made it work. And I sat in on a classroom as a seventh grade science teacher was teaching the kids about climate change. It was a climate unit that he taught every year. And in the middle of that unit, one little boy raised his hand and said, you know, hey, I'm confused. My parents say that climate change isn't real. And so, you know, I don't know what to believe. And so it just was pretty gutting. I mean, he was not the only kid in that class that felt that way. There are many. And so, you know, it's just gutting to see that in this class of children who could legitimately be called climate refugees, because as we know, these mega fires are fueled by climate change. They were still getting climate denial messages from the adults in their lives.
As we wrap up, can you just tell us what kids in the Marshall Islands have to do with you deciding to write this book, Miseducation?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was a reporter for Frontline, and a colleague and I were assigned a story to in the Marshall Islands, which is famously endangered by sea level rise. And we went there and we started talking to kids there, and we were just stunned by how fluent they were when they were talking about climate change. They could talk about the causes. They could talk about what it would mean for their own future in a way that felt much more informed than a lot of adults that I know can speak about it. You know, one of those kids that we were talking to, his family was at the time considering moving to Oklahoma, and in part because his parents wanted him to have, make sure that their kids had a really great education. So the question arose, okay, well, if these kids move to Oklahoma, what might they learn about climate change? And as you heard with Petro Pete, they may not be learning anything about climate change, but they would almost certainly be getting messages from the fossil fuel industry.
Well, Katie Wirth, I want to thank you so much for your work, investigative reporter. Congratulations on your book out this week, Miseducation, How Climate Change is Taught in America. Next up, we go to British Columbia, where Canadian police have raided a First Nations blockade to prevent construction of a new pipeline on Indigenous lands. Stay with us. Everything is everything, from the album The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Canada, heavily militarized officers with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police raided Wet'suwet'en territory Thursday with assault rifles and dogs, trying to put an end to a 50-day Indigenous blockade to block TransCanada's 400-mile, $4.7 billion coastal gas link pipeline. At least 14 people were arrested. The raid came on the same day Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau met with President Biden at the White House, as 18,000 residents of British Columbia remain cut off by floodwaters and mudslides after torrential rains brought what officials have described as a 1-in-500-year flood. The Wet'suwet'en occupation started in September and halted the company's efforts to build a key portion of the over 400-mile pipeline that would transport natural gas from Dawson Creek in northeastern British Columbia to the province's north coastal region. On Thursday, Molly Wickham, an Indigenous land defender, recorded this video during the police raid.
The RCMP are invading Wet'suwet'en territory once again. There have been approximately 15 arrests that have happened already at T'kidim Den checkpoint. Legal observers, media have been arrested. Two of our Wet'suwet'en elders have been arrested and removed from the territory. Right now we're at Coyote Camp and the RCMP are moving in to remove me from my territory. This invasion, once again, speaks to the genocide that's happening to Indigenous people that are trying to protect our water for our future generations. It's infuriating. It's illegal, even according to their own means of colonial law. We need to shut down Canada. Our Haudenosaunee relatives have been arrested, violently arrested. They've been removed from our territories. They're removing Wet'suwet'en people from our own lands. They're planning to drill under Wet'suwet'en and destroy our sacred headwaters. We need people to act. You need to act where you are now. Shut down major infrastructure. Do whatever you can. Rally against the investors. Shut down the investors to this project so that it is very clear that Indigenous people will not stand for the genocide that's happening to our lands and to our future generations.
Thursday's raid came after the Wet'suwet'en Nation issued its own eviction notice on Sunday to Coastal GasLink workers. When the workers attempted to access the roads, Indigenous land defenders refused to allow them to enter. The workers then reported the blockade to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and issued an injunction.
Roads closed.
Roads closed, man, no matter what you say.
So we're here from Coastal GasLink Project. We are here to conduct work on behalf of the Coastal GasLink Project, and you're impeding us. Can you please move your blockade out of the area?
Nothing to say.
We have a court injunction, BC, requesting that anyone having no are restrained from and physically restricting conducting work. Will you remove your blockade to allow us to conduct our work? As you're not removing your blockade and continuing to... we'll be advising that we will be reporting this to the RCMP as a breach of injunction order. Here's a copy of the injunction. Thank you for your time.
The Indigenous land defenders then burned the injunction in a bonfire. For more, we go to Molly Wickham, also known as Slado. She's a land defender matriarch of the Gedemten clan of Wet'suwet'en Nation. We heard describing the raid as it happened. She's a leader in this protracted battle against the pipeline. Molly, welcome back to Democracy Now! Describe more in detail what has taken place, the raid yesterday, and what this means, why you've been devoting scores of days to this.
Yeah, so today is day 56 of the occupation of the drill pad site. There were Coastal GasLink plans to drill underneath Wet'suwet'en, which is our sacred headwaters, one of our last clean drinking water sources, our major spawning salmon river. No consent to drill under Wet'suwet'en or cross Wet'suwet'en whatsoever by our nation. On Sunday, November 14th, the Coastal GasLink was given 8 hours notice to evacuate the territory based on an eviction order by the hereditary chiefs of the Wet'suwet'en Nation of all five clans in January of 2020. And so this was an enforcement of that order in order to show Coastal GasLink and the investors and the people that are, supporting this project, that this project does not have the free, prior, informed consent of the Wet'suwet'en people. And so we provided the workers from the man camp 8 hours to vacate the territory. All of the vehicles were allowed out of the territory. Right as the deadline was approaching, the RCMP called Chief Wass and asked for a 2-hour extension, which Chief Wass granted to them. So they had 10 hours to leave the territory before the road was closed. And after, they did not make one move to try to leave the territory. We were informed later that Coastal GasLink workers, not all of them, were told by Coastal GasLink and instructed to leave the territory or that they would be blocked in. And so nobody left. They all stayed there voluntarily. And then the road was closed after 10 hours of giving them the opportunity to leave.
Can you talk about the corporation directly that's involved and its relationship to the Canadian government?
Yeah, so the corporation, the owners are the TC Energy, KKR, which is a private equity investment firm, and AIMCO, which is an investment firm as well from Alberta, which actually is caught up with Alberta RCMP pension funds. And so TC Energy owns the least amount, and there's also the major investors are the major five Canadian banks that are, and RBC, Royal Bank of Canada, is the one funding most of the construction for this project. And so there's a lot of Canadian pension funds that are invested in these private equity firms that are paying, that own this company. and around the world. There's huge investment into this company that people aren't even aware that it's their pension funds that are paying for this destruction of our territory.
On Wet'suwet'en territory, the Gedimtan clan set up a cabin on the drill pad site where Coastal GasLink plans to drill.
This is the drill pad site where they plan to drill under Wet'suwet'en. And we have a new home here, a new cabin here, a log cabin that's going to be here and stay here. And we'll be housing Kasia and Gedimtan and Wet'suwet'en people for generations to come. And they won't be coming in here anytime soon to be drilling under Wet'suwet'en. We're occupying this space. People are going to be living here, and it'll be occupied from now on.
Is that where you are right now, Slata?
Yes, we are at Coyote Camp, which is the drill pad site. Denise Awas, our house chief for our Kasia house of the Gedimtan clan, his daughter is currently residing in that cabin at Coyote Camp. And we are holding down. Coyote Camp has not been raided. We just heard on the communications that there are two buses of RCMP headed out our way right now on the Forest Service Road. And we're still here, and we're holding this space as long as we possibly can. Yesterday, there was 30 to 50 militarized RCMP that entered Gedimtan Checkpoint, which is another Gedimtan occupation site 20 kilometers down the Forest Service Road from us. And they brought a canine unit, they had helicopters, they had assault rifles, sniper rifles. You know, in previous years, they had lethal overwatch, and I'm sure that was the case yesterday again. There were violent arrests made. Two of our elders were arrested and removed from the territory. One, which was denied her, our matriarch in our house, was denied her medication after an exclusion zone was set up by the RCMP. And then she was sent to hospital yesterday with chest pains because she had not received her heart medication.
Last year in Ontario, a Mohawk solidarity protest shut down the Canadian National Railway for days, halting travel for tens of thousands of passengers. I want to turn to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau responding to the solidarity protests.
We recognize the important democratic right, and we will always defend it, of peaceful protest. This is an important part of our democracy in Canada. But we're also a country of the rule of law, and we need to make sure those laws are respected. That is why I am encouraging all parties to dialogue to resolve this as quickly as possible.
So if you could respond to what Prime Minister Trudeau is saying. He just met yesterday with President Biden and the Mexican President AMLO, Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador. He's pushing for Line 5 through Michigan, which the Michigan governor has said no to, afraid it'll pollute the Great Lakes. Overall, your message, this in the midst of, in another part of British Columbia, you have these 1-in-500-year floods.
Yeah, so I do want to speak to Trudeau's rule of law. I feel like the rule of law is inherently racist. And when they use that terminology in this context, it's extremely racist because it does not consider Indigenous law. It's as if we don't exist as Indigenous people and that we don't have our own governance and that we don't have our own system of law. And calling the rule of law and following the rule of law in Canada totally erases us as Indigenous people. And we are here holding up Wet'suwet'en law. That is why we are here. We are not here. We're not protesters. We're not just here protesting, you know, this one project. We're here to uphold Wet'suwet'en law as we have for thousands of years. And that means protecting our river at all costs. At this time, there's a, you know, BC declared a state of emergency. And so there are people literally stranded on their roofs. There are people that have died. And the RCMP have sent in two plane loads, four buses full, and multiple helicopters to use in raiding our territory on unarmed Indigenous people. And so that to me, that, you know, this climate crisis that has caused this disaster, and the resources that the government is willing to direct to criminalizing Indigenous people instead of addressing the actual climate issue speaks to
The discrepancy between
Molly
what is
Wickham,
being said and the
we're
government.
We're going to have to leave it there, also known as SLEDO. We'll continue to cover this issue. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Are you ready?
Are you ready for the sound experience of a lifetime? Are you ready for crystal clarity in sonic bliss? Are you ready for CKUT? We're ready for you. 90.3 on your FM dial.
If you have flu-like or COVID-19-like symptoms, such as fever, cough, loss of taste or smell, or if you have been in contact with someone infected with the virus, it's essential to get tested and to follow isolation instructions, even if you're vaccinated. Screening remains one of the best ways to limit outbreaks. To find out more, visit quebec.ca/test-COVID-19. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Passam pássaros e aviões, e no chão os caminhões. Passa o tempo, as estações, passam andorinhas e verões. Passe em casa, tô te esperando, tô te esperando. Passe em casa, tô te esperando, tô te esperando. Estou